Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Remember the 5th of October. It's the 5th of October, folks, and that can only mean one thing. It is the 60th anniversary of the Beatles' second single. And we're here to talk about that and many other things that are going on in the Beatle universe, because I think people have gone 1962 crazy, Stephen.
They have. It's an anniversary, Jason. You're never more than 12 months away from an anniversary.
Yes, they come around every year. And the anniversary that everybody seems to be crazy about is the Love Me Do anniversary. So we thought we would, you know, since it is the 5th of October, we would celebrate the 5th of October, because why not get on board the good ship 5th of October, as everybody else seems to be? But
why not? We're lighting bonfires and...
That's still a month away. But if there is a claim to... what should be International Beatles Day? Would you claim the 5th of October? I had a feeling maybe last year when Get Back came out that Thanksgiving should be relabeled as kind of a Beatles festival.
Yes, yes.
But if we have to have a public holiday, 5th of October?
I think 5th of October is as good a claim as any.
Yeah, I think so. And we were talking about this before we were recording, but Love Me Do, not really their debut.
Go on, you have a theory.
Well, I don't have a theory. I just have hard, cold facts. And we do like to occasionally do a bit of debunking, but the reality is Love Me Do was not the first single released in Britain in 1962 that had the Beatles' name on it.
But was it the first Beatles single?
Well, how do you define a Beatles single? Look, of course, from a canon point of view, it is the debut single from the Beatles, and it's written by Lennon and McCartney, and it deserves all the accolades. It's the opening track on the Beatles one and all the rest. But there was a song, you know, there was a record that came out in January 1962 that had the Beatles name on it. Not the Beat Brothers, but the actual Beatles with Tony Sheridan.
The Beatles.
The Beatles. Well, yes, this is going to be a long meandering chat, because we've kind of had a couple of doses of 1962, and you know, we can't, you know, look at the figures. My Bonnie by Tony Sheridan and the Beatles came out as an official UK release on the 5th of January 1962, and this was triggered by the famous story that people wanted it to be bought in Brian Epstein's shop, and somebody went in and said, you know, do you have this? And so it wasn't just pure imports that made it happen, but there was a Polydor UK single that came out in January 62 with the Beatles' name on it. And yeah. I find that interesting that, you know, it didn't really, obviously it didn't register and it wasn't a big hit, or nobody really paid attention until after the Beatles became the Beatles. But it's often something that it's kind of seen as an anomaly, that it happened in Germany, it happened far away, but it was a genuine UK release, My Bonnie.
It was, so we should be saying, remember the 5th of January is the...
well...
You're saying that's International Beatle Day is the 5th of January.
Well, yeah, it's sort of the 11th day of Christmas as well. So, you know, it would be a good way to slot in a bit of Beatles celebration over the New Year's and Christmas period.
Well, there's only one problem. There is only one problem.
Okay, what is the one problem?
It's not very good.
Well, yes, that is true. It is not very good. Although it does exist nowadays on Anthology 1. It is, so it's an official part. You could say it's an official part of the Beatles canon that way. You can go and buy a Beatles album with it on.
I shall never be saying that, Jess.
No? Okay, fine.
I'd rather say that Goodbye was part of the official canon.
Well, so Love Me Do is 60 years old today. That is the reality of it. But there's a couple of things that we want to talk about related to 1962 that are going on. And just to join in the general celebration of, it was 60 years ago today. Oh, my goodness. And, you know, 60 years before that was 1902. So I don't really know if any of the kids of 1962 were bopping to any of the hot sounds of 1902. Probably not.
No,
but the first thing we want to talk about is that we were lucky enough to get a seat to see Mark Lewison's latest Evolver show in London a few weeks ago, and it's playing in London this weekend. And the whole theme of this show is to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Beatles entering the public sphere, is, you know, and the release of Love Me Do. And it's, if people are listening to this before, you know, if you, obviously people listen to this on the day it goes out, you should try and get your tickets to Mark Lewison ASAP, because there are still some seats left. He's only doing shows in London, but I thought it was an excellent show. What did you think?
I thought it was an excellent show, and absolutely, I would recommend that you go and see it. It was incredibly entertaining. I learned a lot. Do we know everything about the Beatles? No, we don't.
You should have stolen that line. Yes, you all think you know the Beatles. You don't.
Yeah, but it was very well put together. I mean, not giving anything away, but he references individual sort of items and artifacts throughout the show to tell the story, and it's very, very engaging story, and lots of new information. I mean, it's really, I suppose, information that is largely in TuneIn, but he's refined it and expanded upon it. And in a couple of cases, he's adding new information into that and sort of qualifying or expanding on what he said in the book. So,
We don't want to give away the show. We want people to go and see the show, but it's, it celebrates, the show is called Evolver, you know, 1962. And I very much subscribe to Mark's theory that the Beatles in 1962 were just as interesting and as exciting as the Beatles of 1969 in Get Back. They were always interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
We just didn't have the coverage in 1962 or 61 or 63 that we had when they pointed the cameras in January 1969. So his notion that these four guys are fascinating no matter what year it is really interesting. And, you know, 1962, what he really delivers, I thought, across the show was how busy they were. And he really gave a sense of their momentum.
Yes. That the fact that Epstein is on board and there is a very deliberate drive, you know, there is an ambition there. You get a sense that prior to 1962, there was an element of drift. You know, he talks about this in Tune In, that, you know, they were considering their future. They were, you know, there were various points at which they might have broken up, at which Paul might have decided to go and be an English teacher or wind coils for a living.
Wind coils. He's the lead singer of the Flaming Lips.
Yes, I believe so. Terrible band.
Terrible band.
And
I love the Flaming Lips, but that's not a surprise.
No, that is definitely not a surprise. Yeah. Anybody that's seen your hair can realize you're
turning into wind coils.
Some sort of tribute hairdo. I think it's the fact that there is a drive to forward, as you say, it's momentum, and that comes across. This is the next step, and there's much more focus to what they're doing, where there had been a bit of drift before that. And the big thing that's changed, obviously, is they have a manager, and he's setting targets, and his role comes across very clearly in the show that Mark is doing.
I think you're absolutely right. Now, and we're not going to put spoilers out to the show, but he basically tells a chronological tale of 1962 in 62 items, and you know, they cover various forms. We're not going to tell you what they were, but he uses each one as a springboard into a, you know, 62 different parts of the story. And, you know, you kind of think, is there, you know, 62 things? Yes, there are. He is very, very good at doing that thing that he does where he, you know, starts off at one point, looks at it from a certain direction, and then, you know, makes you realize something else. But, you know, the main arc of the show, you know, starts with the 1st of January. And we all know the 1st of January is Decca audition day. That's famously it. And you kind of think of the year, you know, that's how they started on the 1st of January, 62. And they end on the 31st of December, 1962. They've got Love Me Do in the charts. They're signed to EMI Parlophone. They are on the up, and none of it happens by accident. You know, that's what's interesting. There are happy accidents.
Yes.
But the plan is always, you know, to get a record contract, to get a record out. And it's a very maybe obvious thing to notice, but The thing Mark Lewisohn does talk about is that, you know, the Beatles had lit a fire in Liverpool, and he wanted, Brian realised that, you know, if you could get those fires to light up around the country and then join together, that's what you wanted to do. And you do forget that by January 1962, the Beatles were huge in Liverpool. They, you know, Mersey beat Pole and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, I mean, I think that's one of the analogies he uses, which is sort of you start little fires elsewhere outside the Liverpool area, and then eventually they sort of take over the country. So there was what came across for me was that very deliberate design, that almost like a military campaign. You know how they were moving forward, and the other thing is it's an incredibly entertaining show. You know, I thought, well, yes, there is a danger that this type of thing descends into, and then they did this, and then they did that, or here's an interesting object, but it was fascinating and it rattled along at pace.
It did. It's also not a spoiler to say that it's in two halves, and each half is 62 minutes long, which is a very high concept for a show about 62.
Yeah, I have to say it was very well put together, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect, and I thought it was going to be more in the nature of a lecture or a talk. Yeah. But it's actually an entertainment as well. I mean, it was very enjoyable, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, Mark's other show, Hornsey Road, which, you know, celebrated Abbey Road, which he toured in 2019, you know, was a great show. But that was more kind of lectury. But this kind of 62 show, I felt had real twists and turns, and I wasn't really knowing what he was going to present us with next. And so it was an absolute pleasure to be there, and if you can get a chance to get to it this weekend, go and see it. I think there's talk that, I don't know whether he wants to record it or try and get it to people in some form in the future. Hopefully it's not going to disappear into the ether.
He did mention that, and he was saying he's torn between, you know, you want to do the show and get it out to people, but it is a distraction from that other thing that he's doing.
Well, he came out at the start of the show, because this was you know, myself and Stephen, we're still, you know, bemused by the novelty of getting a media invite. This is very quaint. I know, you know, this is some people's full-time jobs, but to get a media invite, and he came out and said a few words beforehand, and he basically started by saying something like, yeah, I'm working on it. No, I don't know when it's coming out. That's kind of how he opened the afternoon. Yeah. And then at the end of the afternoon, somebody who obviously had arrived late when there was a Q&A put up their hand and went, can I ask when's the book being done? And everyone's like, boo. So I think I feel so sorry for him, because it's the question that that sort of hangs over his head so much.
Well, it's like, you know, will you get back together again? Will the Beatles get back together again? It's just like that, you know, the question hangs over every interview. We didn't ask him that when he came on the podcast. We very deliberately didn't ask him that.
No, I mean, I think it's just one of those things where he just doesn't need to be asked. I'm sure if he could press a button, wave a magic wand, whatever, he'd publish the book tomorrow. But, you know, he did also allude in the Q&A afterwards that, yeah, there's information coming in about 1962. Of course he'd like to rewrite Tune In. So as long as he doesn't say, I'm going to rewrite Tune In and first, then work on volume two, that would be a worry. But yeah, Evolver 62, Mark Lewisohn's show, is in the Bloomsbury Theatre in London this weekend in October, if you're listening to us on International Beatles Day, the 5th of October. And we thoroughly recommend it and enjoy it. And it was nice to see Mark again. And he's, you know, he knows his stuff.
He does. He does. I think he demonstrated that 62 times during the course of the day.
He did. And I can't remember. There was one person in the audience who sort of had that, I think you'll find, tone to their question. I think you'll find. Yes. And he was very like, no, I don't think so. So, yes, good old Mark Lewisohn. That's Evolver 1962. One of the key events of 1962 that he talks about is Pete Best.
Yes, and one of us has met Pete Best recently.
Yes, well, he's now my close personal friend. I don't know, but I did post the picture up on the socials, the Nothing Is Real socials. He did a public speaking event in Dublin.
Can I say, I put that photograph up on the Facebook group. It got more likes than any other post I've ever put up on the Facebook group.
Well, that's Stephen's telling me this because obviously I
despise Facebook.
I stay away from Facebook because it's but I got a lot of nods on Twitter. I funnel my addiction into Twitter. That's where my online addiction lies.
I know you only do it for the likes. I know you only do it.
Like and subscribe and all the rest. I have to admit it was very unfortunately you couldn't make it down, but it was a very charming show for Pete to kind of tell his story. And this was a show that was announced originally at the end of 2019 and has been postponed due to, you heard about this thing, COVID? It's been postponed due to COVID. And eventually it happened 2.5 years later than it was supposed to. But it was a packed house in Lost Lane. And the format is that Rogue Best, another friend of the show, interviews Pete in as much as it's, a planned kind of staged conversation. So, you know, and then your mum bought a house. Would you like to tell us about that? And Pete would talk about the house and all that kind of stuff. So there were some bits of the story that you knew, some bits that you didn't know, but there's no denying the fact, and this sounds very stupid, that he was there for 2 years in the Beatles. And, you know, he was in the room when it happened.
He was in the room when it happened. It was, you know, I wasn't there, but it was whenever we were talking to Howie Casey earlier in the year.
Yeah.
And he suddenly said, well, yes, you know, Stuart Sutcliffe said this or Stuart Sutcliffe did that. And you suddenly thought, I'm talking to somebody that knew Stuart Sutcliffe.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of was in the room, was in that sort of environment when all those things were happening, that has firsthand interaction with the key players. And, you know, one step closer, Pete Best was a key player up to 1962.
And Howie Casey got a shout out on Pete's show because, you know, Pete recounts, you know, arriving in Hamburg and, you know, that, you know, they've beaten the Beatles to Liverpool, from Liverpool to Hamburg already. And he sees Howie Casey playing on stage with Derry and the Seniors, and he, you know, he watches that band. And he, so you're thinking he's there, and he's also recounting, you know, arriving in Hamburg for his last trip, the Beatles' second last trip, and finding out that Stuart had died, you know, finding out on the runway. So, you know, he's a guy who was there. I guess the tricky part of the Pete Best story is Pete Best leaving the Beatles. And that is a perspective that changes depending on who you ask, he said, politically.
and how did he handle that? Or how did Rogue handle that? Did you say, and then...
Yeah,
you got a phone call and...
That's more or less it. It's kind of like they, you know, Pete's recounting the story chronologically. He's recounting, you know, the session that he's at in June 62 for Love Me Do. And, you know, and Rogue says, so this, it's kind of alluded to like, well, you know, we all know what's going to happen. You know, it's just like, oh, I bet this guy had a fine career with this band that were up and coming. You know, we all know the elephant in the studio is that, you know, he's leaving. So he says, you know, so I think Rogue said it up along the lines of, but then you had the meeting with Brian, you know, tell us about that. And so he recounts it, and he still recounts, you know, that he had no idea that this was coming. No idea it was going to happen, totally out of the blue. And, but he still attests that it was nothing to do with skills. You know, that it was to do that he was as good a drummer as Ringo Starr, that he was a great drummer. He even said at one point, you know, that it was on the horizon that they'd be going back to Abbey Road. This is how he framed it, to do Love Me Do again, but that there'd be a session drummer, and that, you know, he had been kind of told by George Martin that Abbey Road just couldn't capture the thundering sound of his drums. And so that was the reason why. That was the reason why a session drummer was due to be planned, even though the next session didn't have a session drummer.
Didn't have a session
after that. So that's how he recounts it. So, you know, it's such a difficult thing because, you know, thinking about it afterwards, you know, my take on it was that the Beatles created so many archetypes in popular culture, particularly for bands, but in other forms of entertainment. That we still follow today. So we say, oh, that record is their Sergeant Pepper. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or this person is, you know, the malevolent influence. You know, I don't want to blame Yoko for anything, but Yoko's sometimes used as an archetypal shorthand. And but Pete Best is also one of these archetypes. He is the archetype for the person who missed out, who just didn't quite make it. And so it's a bit like, this is a very odd reference, the movie Kingpin, where they invent the name Munson for people who are, you know, we've been Munsoned in the middle of nowhere. It's where you know you get this name for yourself for the circumstances are personally very difficult to deal with, but that is his point in history. He is a Pete Best, and other groups have their Pete Bests who leave the story at a certain key point in time and they don't get to see the glory, you know?
Yeah. And was he well received? You know, was he getting a sympathetic?
I thought the audience were really sympathetic, really interested. And it was very, like, the setup of the show is there was about a 70-minute back and forth between Rogue and Pete. As I said, you know, it was kind of half scripted, prepped. Mm. That's absolutely fine. You know, you heard what you wanted to hear. And then there was a small intermission. I went upstairs and Pete was kind of sitting on his own. There was a couple of people milling around, so I just sat down and introduced myself. And because we'd spoken on our little promo episode that we put out, and he was chatting for about 3 minutes, and I just asked him very straightforward questions. Because in my mind, I'm like, be cool, you know. Yeah, he's a very straightforward Beatle. I'm sitting on a sofa. He's a straightforward, unassuming guy, very lovely, but you're kind of like, this is very unusual that he's just sitting there. And he was very nice and very decent and got that lovely picture and shook his hand. And then there was a kind of a 45-minute Q&A. And, you know, he was actually, it was very interesting, the Q&A. He was, you know, he's quite funny. He's got a bit of scouse in him and he's, you know, very laid back. So there was one or two questions where he'd, you know, kind of get the crowd on his side with this kind of tone of, what the hell are you asking me? Like, somebody asked him in a very roundabout way, you know, what was his favourite, you know, what's his favourite drumming on any Beatles song? And he sort of says, well, one of mine or one of Ringo's. And they're like, well, one of each. He says, well, I'm not going to choose one of Ringo's, you know, you idiot. The crowd were kind of on his side going, yeah, like, that's a stupid question to ask Pete Best. So it was all very lovely. And, but, you know, there's this issue of, you know, he left the, as George says in Anthology, you know, Ringo was a Beatle. He just didn't enter until that part of the movie. And history attests to that. You know, the other thing I realized is, you know, we've got, everybody has sliding doors moments in their life all the time. And 99.9% of the time, you don't know what the alternate is. Yes. So he is in the unfortunate position of seeing the alternate version of his life play out on the grandest scale imaginable. And the Beatles has caused people lots of madness in trying to deal with it personally. And, you know, seeing that probably was very, very difficult for a long period of time. I feel like he's made his peace and he's claiming his part in it. And as I said, he was there for 2 years. He was the man. Why shouldn't he?
Why shouldn't he? And I do think it's something that you mentioned with Rogue. I mean, I do think it's good that the Best family, not just Pete, but, you know, Rogue and their mother, that part of the story is being retold. And I suppose we're as guilty as anybody of ignoring, when I say we, I mean the podcast is as guilty as anyone of ignoring that early 1960s Hamburg Love Me Do. Pre My Bonnie. Did he talk about the My Bonnie session at all?
He did. Yeah, he talked about My Bonnie being recorded in the big hall, and he talked about Bert Kampfert and recording with Tony Sheridan. So he covered all of that. So, because he said, you know, this is going to be the Beatles' first single of 1962, and it's not going to be Love Me Do. No, he didn't say that. But he talked about that recording session and recording My Bonnie, and, you know, how Bert Kampfert had kind of, you know, set all of this up. And he told the story that they were the Beat Brothers because they couldn't call themselves the Beatles because of Beatles, which is a German slang for the male appendage.
Very medical of you there.
Yes, I'm very vague. And he told all of that. And But he sort of told in the frame of we were just happy to get a record and get recording and get it out. He sort of said, oh, we thought we'd be in a big recording studio, but we weren't. We were just in this school hall. So he did talk about that and how, you know, that's the single that led Brian to the Beatles and all the rest. So he did cover that as well, you know.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, and he's now your close personal showbiz friend.
He is now my close personal showbiz friend, and
did you get a nice invite to Liverpool or?
Not yet. I unfortunately had to run off at the end. I didn't get chatting to Rogue himself at the time. I had to run off for other very important rock and roll reasons, which maybe I won't go into here. The other kind of thought that I had when I was thinking about it in the following days was, you know, this notion that he did not know Brian was going to fire him, right? Mm. And I kind of thought, there's no version of events where any other Beatle was going to be fired. That's kind of what I don't know if this makes sense, but there was no version of events where John, Paul and Pete were going to fire George.
No.
Or John, George and Pete were going to fire Paul, or Paul, George, Pete were going to fire John.
No.
The firing of it, of Pete, the schism of John, Paul, George and Pete, I don't want to say it makes sense, but it wasn't going to, the way it was going to be.
No, it wasn't going to divide up any other way. Mm. I mean, one of the things that I've been rereading, or rather re-listening to tune in the audiobook, and one of the things that really comes across is the fact that Pete almost sort of isolated himself from the other three. There's sort of first-hand accounts of people in Hamburg, but also first-hand accounts of fans in Liverpool, and they're sort of saying, oh, well, you know, the other three hung about together. You could see them sitting in the bar before a show or after a show, but you never saw Pete socializing with them at all. And that wasn't just a Hamburg phenomenon, but actually in Liverpool as well. Pete went with them to NEMS to listen to records because he had to learn the parts. Songs. But the choosing of the songs, you know, the obscure B-sides, that the American import records that they were learning that they wanted to put into their set list, that was all down to the other three.
Yeah.
And he was there because he had to be there. That sort of divide was almost something that he seemed to either create or not really take steps to cure.
Yeah, and he does tell us part of the story that, you know, when his mum Mona was opening the Casbah, you know, the Beatles ended up being the band that opened the Casbah, the Beatles being John, Paul and George, not Pete.
Yes.
And then they have this row with Mona after a number of weeks because it's just escaped me, the fourth guy is running the door.
Doesn't turn up.
Yeah.
And she says, well, we have to pay everybody, and she goes to pay the guy that didn't turn up. And
he's running the door because he feels sick. That was the story. Yeah. And John, Paul and George are like, screw you, we did the playing, we should split the money three ways, not four. Off we go. Was it Chaz Newby? We should be prepared for this. Anyway, and so Pete doesn't enter the band as a drummer until, you know, sometime later. So obviously there's the John, Paul, George dynamic, and you know, part of the story is, you know, Pete comes in because they need the drummer for Hamburg. But it was hearing Pete talk, you know, he's still telling stories that he's there in the room. He sort of talks that he was kind of most pally with McCartney, or that'd be the person who he'd bunk with or who he'd share with. And, but, you know, he's very clear in saying, well, he didn't do prellies and he wasn't doing any of those kind of things. And he talked about that at the time because somebody asked him a Q&A about prellies. And and I'm aware, as you say in the Lewison book, there is this notion that Pete kind of sets himself apart. And I'm always very wary that that's just not, you know, looking backwards, you know, the retrospectoscope. Well, it was obvious looking back. But again, you know, if you cut that cake any other way, you know, Pete and John and Paul weren't going to kick out George. That just was not it made sense that schism was where it was, I think. But, you know, an interesting guy, a fascinating story, very charming. And as you say, the wider best story with Mona and the Casbah and, you know, Rogue and Neil Aspinall and all the rest. It's, you know, they're an essential part of the picture. It's not just Pete's story. It's a best family story. And that's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, I think so. It's the family story is the so when we get invited to the you know, to Liverpool and the museum, and when those invitations start arriving, then we can pick up and cover all of that.
Absolutely. But, you know, speaking of their debut single of 1962, My Bonnie, they did record in Germany on the 22nd of June, 61, and it was released in Germany on the 23rd of October, 61. So it's actually coming up on the 61st anniversary of the Beatles' debut single. But, you know, it did come out in the UK on January the 5th, 1962, with a Polydor UK release. So that same week that they're auditioning for Decca and slowly being turned down and that they're starting to gig, that this single comes out. And I never really got a sense that Brian and the Beatles were particularly aware that the UK release was happening of that single.
No, I mean, you hear George sort of, George is quite keen on that song initially, at least in the early days, and he says, "Oh, it was quite a thing to hear it." But Lennon doesn't like it. But yeah. No, there's no sense that you know, they're recording in Decca suddenly aware that this is about to come out. But they're actually signed to Bert Kaempfert at this point. This is the point. There is a contract in Germany. That Brian then has to get translated, and they have to sort of the outworkings of that. So, and by all accounts, you know, Bert Kaempfert was quite not necessarily happy to see them go, but he certainly facilitated the transfer.
He was pretty magnanimous. He didn't throw any spanners in the works about letting them off the label. But it is also curious that Brian is trying to get them a proper UK recording contract. That, you know, he doesn't have copies of My Bonnie to see. He obviously feels that My Bonnie isn't necessarily indicative of what he wants them to be or how they're going to record. You know, they're not auditioning with it. So it kind of disappears into the background, instead of him having, you know, saying, well, look, these are my boys. Oh, and by the way, look, they had this thing called My Bonnie that they recorded as well. So they're already,
I suppose,
professional to a degree.
Yeah. But I mean, I suppose the thing is, it's like I said, it's not indicative of what they were doing, or you know, one of the key things about the Beatles is the vocal aspect. You know, John, Paul, George, the harmonies, they're just not there, or not in a recognizable Beatles sound. So it's not in any way, I think, representative of even what they were doing at the Decca audition.
No, I think you're totally right. There's, like, you know, My Bonnie could have been played by any band, basically. Yeah. And Lewison does talk about this in his show, that the Beatles notionally were potentially going to be a studio band or a general backing band.
Yes.
But there's no way you listen to My Bonnie and you can hear echoes of anything that they're about to do. It's pretty anonymous. It's competent, but anonymous.
It is. And it's a weird choice of a song. You know, it's a kind of traditional folk song. It's the kind of thing you learn, you know, whenever you're at primary school and you're all learning to play the recorder. And it's I suppose it's kind of sailory sea shanty type. It would have been great during lockdown. They should have released it during lockdown, you know, when sea shanties
like
were big.
Thin Lizzy's Whiskey in the Jar. In a way, it's just the sort of song shoehorned into a form that it's not really belonging in.
Yeah.
And it has a certain charm, I suppose.
Well, I wouldn't even go that far, I have to say. I mean, I remember the disappointment of buying the repackaged The Beatles featuring Tony Sheridan. And it was just awful. Terrible. I think the point is, it sounds like something that was recorded before The Beatles changed everything.
Yes.
If that makes sense. You know, that this could have been recorded at any point from sort of 1958 to 1962. And it's everything that the Beatles swept away. The whole sort of, we talked before about, you know, Al McCogan and Helen Shapiro and people like that, whose careers just came shuddering to a halt when the Beatles arrived. And this is this is like that. This is what it sounds like. You know, it's an all round entertainment type.
Well, it once again shows a band is only as good as its drummer. You know, Ringo hadn't entered the film, as George says, and maybe that's what they were waiting for. You know, that final piece of the puzzle.
It never made their set list. You know, nobody was ever yelling at Shea Stadium asking for them to play My Pony. That would be funny. I mean, I think.
Even they did return to Besame Mucho many times over the years. You know, past Decca auditions and Let It Be sessions and Paul playing it solo years. You know, but never My Bonnie. It just wasn't their thing, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is that comment from John Lennon in 1963 where he says it's just Tony Sheridan singing with us banging in the background. It's terrible. It could be anybody. And I think that's as good an assessment as any, and I refuse to accept it as the first Beatles single. Thank you.
Okay, so fine. So the first Beatles single then is Love Me Do. Is that over? Is that, yes. Do we really? Fine, if you say so.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Love Me Do is 60 years old today. It's also the 32nd anniversary, more or less, of P.S. Love Me Do, the 1990 Paul McCartney B-side, but maybe we won't mention that. It's odd that P.S. Love Me Do is closer to Love Me Do than we are to P.S. Love Me Do.
Ah, this is messing with my head now.
Immortality maths, ladies and gentlemen. But Love Me Do, as their debut single, has this kind of storied background of, you know, they are trying to get onto EMI, and part of the deal is, you know, prepare songs, get songs ready. And they have this song that's been hanging around for years. I think Lennon says it's a Paul song originally.
Yes.
Love Me Do.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a discrepancy here where Lennon says, oh, you know, definitely a Paul song. Paul is saying, oh, it's a 50-50 song. And I think that reflects the fact that it's been kicking around for so long. So supposedly Paul writes it when he was 16, you know, as you do, write your
fair enough
number one US single when you're 16. it is in the set list and it is kicking around, but they have to sort of retool it when they're in Hamburg. So the story is that they get a telegram from Brian on the 9th of May, 1962, saying, we've got a recording contract, rehearse new material. And they think, we have to write some new songs. So they go back to Love Me Do, and they sort of rework it, and they turn it into a more bluesy thing. And this seems to be where Paul has the notion, this is where it becomes a 50-50 co-write.
Yeah. And part of it is this harmonica that John brings to it. I think there was Hey Baby, the Bruce Chanel.
I always thought it was Chanel.
Chanel.
Good part. Made his money in perfume, I think.
And black dresses. That had a harmonica, so they thought, we will use a harmonica. So we might think of the harmonica in Love Me Do as a, you know, just kind of a nice addition, but even the harmonica in Love Me Do is a very small early indication that they wanted to have a little something different in each record, put something new in, that kind of thing.
That's it. I love that. I hadn't seen this quote before, but this Paul said, John expected to be in jail one day and he'd be the guy who played the harmonica. that's a weird thing. So everybody has an input into this. Well, Paul and John and Pete have an input into the arrangement. So Pete comes up with a key element of this retooling of the song.
Yes, and I'm sure it's a key element of the retooling that he comes to regret, because he thinks that, oh, there should be like a, I think he called it like a skip beat in the middle section, yes, Someone to Love section of the song, to make it a little bit different. So he's adding his own arrangement flourishes to the track.
And yes, as you say, this may be something he comes to regret.
Well, Pete is still in the band at this point. So if we're having a bit of an overview of all these kind of interconnected things of 1962, when they wander into the studio on the 6th of June, 1962, it's John, Paul, George and Pete in Studio 3 for a 2-hour session. And they record Besame Mucho, and they record Love Me Do, the skip beat version with Pete on drums that we now know from Anthology 1.
Yes, because this was assumed to have been lost, this initial version. And then it pops up on Anthology 1 and we get to hear the skip beat in all its skippiness.
Yes. It's wonky. I think we have touched upon this before.
It is pretty wonky. But to be fair to Pete, the whole arrangement is wonky.
That is true. Yes.
It's a very awkward transition in and out of that sort of double time skip beat. Well, we say, I don't know what I'm saying skip beat because that's what Pete calls it, but it's very awkward. And maybe it's just awkward because you know the final version, and it's just awkward.
I think it's awkward. It's kind of gauche. It's one thing if the actual beat is a bit all over the place, but it actually, the tempo changes. You know, if the tempo had stayed the same, you might get away with it. But the tempo is not consistent, switching from the different sections of the song. And Ringo is, to paraphrase one of my favourite Ringoisms, you know, when Jeff Lynne asked him to play along to a click track, Ringo said, "I'm the fucking click." So Ringo is a rock solid metronome of a human being, as far as I'm concerned.
Ringo will be pleased to hear that.
Well, no, I mean... You do hear failed takes with Ringo, and first of all, Beatle takes very rarely break down because of something Ringo did. I can't really think of any immediate outtakes where Ringo made the mistake.
No.
He generally is the guy that keeps it all together. It's usually one of the other three that makes the mistake. And, you know, even if something is kind of going off the rails, if Ringo's on drums, it's not going out of time. This version of Love Me Do does not keep its tempo.
No, and it's impossible to ignore. I mean, it draws attention to itself. It stands up and screams, you know, look at me. I'm doing this weird thing in the middle of a song that I shouldn't be here. But it's the harmonica that seems to trigger the interest. And they George Martin is summoned from the canteen and he comes down and starts rearranging the vocal arrangements. Famously, John was having to play the harmonica part and sing the Love Me Do part, and he said, George Martin says, Paul should sing that.
You have to sing the Love Me Do.
Yes, and Paul tells this story in concert. We heard him explain this in concert in 2018, and then I heard him explain it again the following year in exactly the same terms. But Paul plays Love Me Do in his current set list. Did he play that at Glastonbury?
I cannot remember because
so long ago.
I think he did. I don't have to check it. Obviously, if we had notes, we would know. But the whole point of this session, though, is that they don't get their single recorded. And this is the session that is sold to the Beatles as Query. It's like an audition, but the reality is they are actually signed to EMI Parlophone at the time. It's a done deal, and part of it is to do with the publishing with Ardmore and Beechwood for Love Me Do. But the next session that's arranged is for September the 4th, 1962. Now, here's where some stories diverge a little bit, because what has happened in the third week of August 1962 is Pete is out and Ringo is in. Yep. You know, Ringo never, Pete best forever, all that kind of stuff. That happens. And very quickly, the thing I always love about the Beatles stories is all the kind of funny little happenstances of timing, that it's within a week of Ringo joining that they record the Some Other Guy footage in the cavern.
Yes.
Like, if they'd recorded that a week earlier, it would have been Pete on the drums. But we don't really have any moving footage of Pete drumming with the Beatles at all. So the filmed footage arrives just as Ringo arrives, and they turn into this other thing. But it's September the 4th, 62, and George Martin, apparently this is the first he knows that Pete Best has been replaced. I think Pete was kind of intimating that he had spoken to George after getting fired from the Beatles. And I think that's contentious as to whether or not they had any big heart-to-hearts as to what was going on. But George Martin claims that when Ringo rocks up on the 4th of September, they have no idea that Pete Best has been fired.
Yeah, so he's expecting the same lineup as before. So he doesn't know that they have a new drummer. He doesn't know who the new drummer is, and he doesn't know how good or bad the new drummer is. So, of course, in the meantime, he has given them "How Do You Do It" to work up, and you know they don't like this song, but they change it around. They work up an arrangement and they record two takes of "How Do You Do It." Then once they've got that out of the way, because that is going to be the single, then they start recording what is now the B-side, Love Me Do.
Yeah. And in fairness to the Beatles, you know, they give How Do You Do It a decent shot. You know, it's a song that's been sent to them in advance and they're willing to try it, written by Mitch Murray. Mitch Murray is still alive. He is 82 years of age. He's still going strong. He wrote... after writing How Do You Do It and How Do You Do It eventually became a hit for Jerry and the Pacemakers, he wrote them I Like It and You Were Made For Me for Freddie and the Dreamers, and a couple of other songs, Band of Bonnie and Clyde for Georgie Fame, Avenues and Alleyways for Tony Christie.
But then that's a great song. That's a great song. I did not know he wrote that. No, I did not know he wrote that song.
I love that song. And a couple of things, but he hasn't really, he kind of moved away from songwriting after the 60s and became apparently a, you know, noted public speaker, expert and speechwriter and all the rest. So he's still doing well and he lives on the Isle of Man. So that's the sign of somebody who's done well.
I think so. It's my ambition to move to the Isle of Man now that they've obviously brought back the 45% tax rate. You know, that's more incentive to move to the Isle of Man.
That's where Nothing Is Real Inc. is set up, is it?
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah.
So they give How Do You Do It a try, but they want to, you know, get Love Me Do recorded. And this is still Ringo, but it's still not right, isn't it? This is where the notion comes in that they want to do one more go with a session drummer.
Yes. Ringo basically says, you know, he was trying to drum while holding maracas, while holding a tambourine, while trying to do everything. You know, he was not being in a studio environment before, he was sort of overcompensating. That's probably the best way to say it. And, you know, I think there are various accounts that it was just the weirdest thing. And he really just was not comfortable and was...
No, and, you know, Ringo, even though the other Beatles had had a handful of sessions, you know, they'd been to Decca, they'd had one session in Abbey Road, Ringo, 2 weeks earlier, wasn't even in the Beatles. And now, you know, it's a very different set of skills you need to be a studio musician instead of, you know, getting the punters to shake a tail feather on the floor at Butland's holiday camp for Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. So I think, you know, he was trying to use that kind of showman side of himself on his first day in Abbey Road.
Yes. So what he says is, on my first visit in September, which was September the 4th, we ran through some tracks for George Martin. We even did Please Please Me. I remember that because while we were recording it, I was playing the bass drum with a maraca in one hand and a tambourine in the other. I think it's because of that that George Martin used Andy White, the professional, when we went down a week later to record Love Me Do. The guy was previously booked anyway because of Pete Best. So he's got to get that in. George didn't want to take any more chances and I was caught in the middle. I was devastated that George Martin had his doubts about me. I came down ready to roll and heard, we've got a professional drummer. He has apologized several times since, has old George, but it was devastating. I hated the bugger for years. I still don't let him off the hook. So,
yeah, like, it casts a long shadow, this decision.
Yes.
To have a session drummer because, you know, even a noted UK newspaper today has been talking about, you know, oh, the Beatles used to say Ringo wasn't the best drummer in the Beatles. You know, oh, Jesus, shut the hell up. That's nonsense.
Yes.
That's total horse duty. Like, who needs any of that? So this is kind of part of that. And, George Martin is just trying to be pragmatic. They are recording singles in 2-hour sessions And he has had two sessions with the Beatles with different drummers. He doesn't know that they mightn't have another drummer the next time round. Yes. These guys are kind of loose cannons with their drummers, it seems. They are proto Spinal Tap. So he just needs to get the record out. And the whole kind of how do you do it, it's interesting that goes into the rear view mirror, because Mitch Mitchell probably, you know, in retrospect, in September 1962, Mitch Mitchell doesn't know who the Beatles are. He doesn't give a hoot. He wouldn't care if the song goes somewhere else. Now, he's only at the start of his songwriting career, so it's not like that he's a name, but he feels it's a hit single and he probably would prefer it to go to somebody who's known as opposed to this group who nobody have ever heard of from Liverpool.
Well, I think that, and also he didn't much care for what the Beatles had done with it in terms of the arrangement. But I think this is one of the things that comes out in Tune In that was really overlooked beforehand, which is the role of the publishers.
Yes.
You know, Dick James, Ardmore and Beechwood, the role of the publishers in how this plays out. So Dick James does not want this song hidden away as a B-side. Mitch Murray does not want this song going, on a B-side, does not want it being arranged in a way that he doesn't like. So he pulls it. So suddenly Love Me Do is back on the agenda as the A-side of the first single. So it's because of the publishers that we have a sort of a canon by the Beatles, which comprises Lennon McCartney. You know, their very first single is a Lennon McCartney song. Was it very easily not have been a Lennon McCartney song? And that was unique, I would have thought. Nowadays, absolutely, that's pretty commonplace. But, in those days, you just recorded what you were told to record.
So they go back the following week, 1 week later, September 11th. That's the session where Andy White is, the professional drummer. And Ringo's kind of sitting on the sidelines playing the tambourine. And they go through Love Me Do 18 times. And take 18 is the keeper for the single. And sometimes there's a bit of discrepancy about this, that Andy White was at the first session or the second session, but it's definitely 4th of September, Ringo, 11th of September, Andy White. And it's all a bit of a nonsense, really, because both versions get used.
Yes, yes. And a lot of this confusion seems to originate or centre on George Martin's book, Summer of Love, because he talks about the 6th of June session, and then he says to Brian Epstein, Pete Best has to go, and then I brought a professional drummer in. But that's not the way it plays out. But yes, they end up with these different versions, and then they just start chopping and changing between what comes out as a single, so the first early pressings of the single, the one on the red Parlophone label, are the 4th of September version, with Ringo playing drums, no tambourine. But then later pressings of the single on the black Parlophone label, and the version that turns up on the Please Please Me album, are the re-recorded version with Andy White on drums and Ringo playing tambourine. So it's the tambourine
is the signifier.
It's the giveaway.
If you can hear a tambourine, it's not Ringo on drums. But as you say, kind of, you know, the bit that's probably not amplified enough is that they have these two versions, Ringo on drums, Andy White on drums, and in the end they just say, okay, we'll just go with the Ringo version from the 4th of September. That is the version that comes out first. So obviously it was fine. For all of Ringo's self-effacing, I was overplaying, or it was, you know, it wasn't working out, it was obviously good enough, you know?
Well, yes, there does seem to have been sufficient improvement in the next version to say, right, well, we're just going to scrap the Ringo version. Yeah. So the two are sort of coexisting, which is again odd. But one of the interesting things that I came across is that when it's the Andy White version that turns up on the album, on the Beatles Hits EP, and the first US single release. But at some point, George Martin destroys the master tape of the Ringo version. I think at the time the Beatles Hits EP is being done.
All right.
So he at this point must be deciding, well, we've just got to stick with one version. And he sees the first pressings of the single as the anomaly. The Ringo version is the anomaly here.
It's a pity, really. I mean, it is, as I said, some tambourine aside, they're pretty, you know,
I have to say,
it's a huge difference.
No, I have to say, if you play the two of them and I wasn't paying particular attention, I'm not sure I could immediately tell them apart.
You can tell the Pete Best version, though.
He's your close showbiz friend. It's a skip beat.
It's a skip beat. It's too hard. He made it too hard for himself. I find it also very quaint that they are in the studio on the 4th of September and the 11th of September for a single that is due out on the 5th of October. Mm. That the turnaround time from studio into the actual charts, into the actual shops, is 3 weeks there and thereabouts. So
that's pretty fast. That is pretty fast.
There's no vinyl shortage then. So if you want to hear the Ringo version now, it is now the Past Masters version of Love Me Do is where the Ringo Love Me Do lives, if anybody wants it. It's still, there was still the controversy over the 2012 50th anniversary, wasn't there, where they mixed up the versions. That's a strange thing.
How can that happen? So it was ready to go on the 5th of October for the 2012, for the anniversary, and then they suddenly realised, we've used the wrong version. We've used the Andy White version. They had to pull it back, and then it didn't come out until the 22nd of October. So they missed. And you think, how can that happen? It's the Beatles. You know, does nobody paying any attention to this?
Once again, I know you're throwing your hat in the ring for Apple archivist and release coordinator. The song, you know, John writes to Astrid Kircher just a few weeks after the single comes out and says, oh, it's good, but it's not good enough, which I kind of like the fact that he's never happy and he's disappointed from the start.
That is really interesting. That was something I hadn't read before, where he's saying, yeah, it's good, but it's not good enough. And again, it's that idea that comes out in the Lewison show that they are driving forward.
Yeah.
That already, you know, they've recorded their first single, but already they're moving on, they're moving past that. Please, Please Me is kind of in the pipeline, and they're already looking ahead to the next single.
And, you know, in a way that My Bonnie didn't reappear later in their career, Love Me Do does reappear. You know, they play it in 1968 in White Album sessions. They played in 69 during, you know, the Get Back sessions, you know, and we pointed out there that Paul did record his own B-side version. So it's a song that they're proud of.
Can we talk about the Paul B-side version?
Yeah, go on then.
It's awful. It might genuinely be the worst thing he's ever done.
I think that's totally true. So just for a recap, on the off chance you don't know what we're talking about, in 1990, Paul did a song called P.S. Love Me Do, which was a mashup, even years before mashup became a thing, of Love Me Do and its B-side, P.S. I Love You, which I first saw in 1990 on the John Lennon tribute, that very strange John Lennon tribute concert, about May 1990 from the Liverpool Docks, which Sean and Yoko were at, introducing Kylie Minogue and all sorts of strange acts. And Paul sends this video, and Ringo sends some Carl Perkins proto Wilbury stuff to this concert. And
George doesn't bother to turn up.
George doesn't bother to turn up. But P.S. Love Me Do is atrocious. And I was a very early days Beatles fan at the time, and I'd enjoyed Flowers in the Dirt, and I thought that was all great. But I remember seeing that thinking, that is pure embarrassment, that song, that video. It's awful. You can look it up on YouTube. It came out as a B-side, I think, for the birthday single.
He was playing it in his live set.
Oh yeah, it was in his live set on the Flowers in the Dirt tour. It's just crazy.
I don't remember that. I think it must have,
I think it was the later sessions. Yeah. I don't think it was on the UK leg. I think it was when he was in South America or somewhere.
So I have to say, I think that would have scarred me for life, my first time seeing a Beatle, if he'd done that, because it's clunky.
It's terrible. It's dated.
But of course, these are the two songs at that time that Paul owned the copyright.
Exactly. Because these were not Northern songs, they're pre-Northern songs formation, Paul was able to own the songs, and because he owned the songs, his logic, I guess, was just to sort of reinvigorate them, to turn them into a brand new Lennon McCartney song that he would own the publishing on forever.
Well, it's like it's like the Bee Gees saying, you know, once we've done our version of Sgt. Pepper, people will forget about the original. So he probably thought, well, you know, we'll just contemporaneize these songs, and so be warned, stay clear, kids.
hubris is a hell of a drug. It's but you know, the there's an interesting footnote that because Paul owns the publishing for Love Me Do, you have to ask his permission if you want to perform it.
Have we got his permission to perform it? Is this what you're going to reveal? We're about to.
I don't have his permission. But are you aware, Stephen, of a show called The Masked Singer?
I am aware of this in the background. In theory, I have never ever seen an episode.
Okay. The Masked Singer is excellent television. It's for people wear insanely elaborate costumes and they sing in front of judges, and judges have to guess who is under the costume, and at the end of the show they shout, "Take it off," and they take off the head and you go, "Oh my God, it's, you know, John Craven." Amazing. And but recently, on the American version of The Masked Singer, somebody had to write to Paul for permission to sing Love Me Do. And Paul granted permission. And do you know who this person was, Stephen? You probably don't if you're not a Masked Singer fan.
It wasn't Ringo Starr, was it?
It was not Ringo Starr. It was Eric Idle. Eric Idle was under the costume. I think he was a hedgehog or something. I can't remember.
Doug McQuickley.
Well, I thought it was a nice bit of Ruttle's crossover that Dirk had to write a letter to say, "Hi, Paul, how are you doing?" And Eric's backstory is that 3 years ago he had surgery for pancreatic cancer, and he's only gone public with it in the last two or three months. And this was his return to performing, was to go on the Masked Singer and sing Love Me Do with written permission from Paul. So Paul did put out a very coy tweet to say, "A certain friend of mine is singing a certain song tonight and wish him the best of luck," you know.
And did you recognise that it was Eric Idle?
I did not. And I did watch it not knowing it was Eric Idle. I watched the YouTube clip trying to figure it out myself, but I did not know it was Eric. That is the joy of The Masked Singer, Stephen. The reveals are just spectacular. You know, you don't know who's...
Yeah, I shall take your word for it. But it is interesting that Paul has obviously forgiven him for Dirk McQuickley and the role. Because Paul wasn't happy, wasn't too pleased.
Oh, we know Paul is the least Ruttle-friendly Beatle.
Yes, and it, so, supposedly it was Linda that sort of broke the ice, you know, after Eric Idle and Paul met after the Ruttles, and she was sort of making some comment, but well, that's nice.
That is nice. Well, the other thing, you mentioned Ringo there, Ringo has done a version of Love Me Do, a solo version of Love Me Do.
Yes, and it's on Vertical Man. I don't know if that's probably an album you play on a regular basis.
Oh yeah, definitely, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's okay, Vertical Man.
Yeah, it's fine, and it features Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, my favorite.
Your favorite? You love Aerosmith.
I love Aerosmith.
All the guilty pleasures are getting named.
I saw Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stones, and Aerosmith within a space of 8 days, and you know who the best was?
Paul McCartney.
Guess again.
Rolling Stones.
Guess again. It was Aerosmith.
The baby of Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones.
They were so good. They were so good. But yeah, so he, and it is, you, there was a sense of Ringo sort of reclaiming the song. You know, he makes that point, you know, that this is my version of Love Me Do. I think he's done it live as well.
Yeah, and there is, you know, rumours of a Treatles version of Love Me Do.
Yes, this is interesting. So when they all got together at George's house, nice motor, etc., etc. There's some footage of them playing, and it seems to be "Love Me Do." So you think that would be quite interesting. Mm. Paul could take that and mash it up with something else.
Guys, I've done something with "Love Me Do." It's going to blow your minds.
That would be bad. Oh. That would be bad. So yeah. But I mean, that would be interesting. That would be interesting.
So Love Me Do, yeah, it's 60 years since it came out. I wonder when was the 60th anniversary of people hearing it for the first time? Because the nice thing, if we're tying this all up again, is that as Mark Lewisohn was revealing the story of 1962, he talks about how, you know, sometimes we look at Love Me Do and think, oh, it only got to 17 in the charts, and, you know, Brian was involved somewhere. But Mark Lewison makes the point that this was a song that went up the charts in consecutive weeks after it came out for the last, you know, 10 or 12 weeks of 1962. So
yes,
it didn't just come in at 17. It had a slow build and people started noticing. So, you know, do we know when the first play was? We know that the Beatles played it on radio themselves.
Yes, yes. I don't. I mean, I don't know when the first time you would have heard this on the radio would have been. But the thing is, it didn't sound like anything else at the time.
Yeah.
That's the point. So if we, you know, the point I was making about, you know, My Bonnie, you could play that on the radio beside Alma Cogan or Helen Shapiro or any of those songs that were happening at the time. And it wouldn't stand out. This stands out. You know, this is different. This is kind of gritty. This is a northern. Yeah. This is a northern song. This sounds unlike anything.
It's not Cliff and the Shadows.
It's not Cliff and the Shadows.
And Cliff and the Shadows are what is number one in the album charts, and they are.
Yeah.
There's a fantastic 1962 Cliff and the Shadows live album which has Beatlemania screaming on it. If you know, the Beatles didn't invent crowds and screaming, but yeah, this is the first part of the next thing. You can hear it evolve on the 142 seconds of Love Me Do.
Can I give you my Cliff fun fact, Tony Sheridan fact?
Oh, go on.
That Tony Sheridan was intended to be the guitar player in The Shadows. And Cliff's producer went down to the Two Eyes Coffee Club or whatever it was called in Old Compton Street to get him, and he wasn't there. So he went with another guitar player by the name of Hank Marvin.
Good old Hank Marvin.
So there you go. So Tony Sheridan, can I just keep giving you fun facts about...
Okay, give me more. Hit me up with Tony Sheridan facts.
Tony Sheridan toured with Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran in 1960 and asked, could he have a lift in their car to the next venue? They said no. And that was the car. That was the car accident that injured Gene Vincent and killed Eddie Cochran.
Yep. Oh my Lord. Gosh.
So there you go. Do you want my last fun fact about Tony Sheridan?
Go on.
He is an honorary captain in the US Army.
Okay. Or was, I guess.
I was, yes. He died in 2013. He toured in Vietnam to entertain the troops. And one of his band was shot by the Viet Cong.
While they were playing?
Well, I don't know why they were playing, around. But while they were there, and he was
do
shot.
Do my Bonnie!
That was probably it. And best of all, he wrote a song with Paul McCartney.
Now, tell us about that.
Well, there's a song written in June 1961 or December 1962, depending on who you believe. And it's called Tell Me If You Can. And it was not recorded until 1997, and supposedly by Tony Sheridan, and supposedly Paul blocked this song from coming out in 1997. But it then was officially released in 2005 on a CD, which I do not have, called Chantal Meets Tony Sheridan, which sounds like one of those movies that, you know.
Yes.
Well, anyway,
that your mother warned you about.
But Chantal is actually the name of a band. And it's given the writing credit McCartney Sheridan, and we can put a link up to a YouTube.
Yeah, it is on YouTube. It's a pretty little song, and Tony's got a nice voice. Actually, you know, it's kind of nice to hear him removed from the hoopla of Beatledom.
Well, if you get a chance to see the complete Beatles, you know, the available on Laserdisc.
Yeah,
he is on that, and he is so cool.
Yes,
being interviewed, and that must be sort of the late 70s, because he was recording with Elvis's band in 1978. He recorded an entire album with the Taking Care of Business band and Klaus Voormann, and again another album that just didn't see the light of day. I think it was one of those TV only albums. You know, Morris Levy probably involved in some way, but So yeah, but he's incredibly cool guy in the late 70s.
He's very, very cool. And I know we mentioned The Complete Beatles in our first anthology, The Road to Anthology episode. Mm. The Complete Beatles is just amazing. It has this thing like, you know, the World at War, where it's recorded at a point in time where everybody's still young and fresh-faced and remembers what happened. But Tony Sheridan is a highlight of The Complete Beatles. So To wrap up our celebration of October the 5th, International Beatles Day, and it was 60 years ago today. So to end our celebration of it was 60 years ago today, there's probably there's a nice little anecdote related to Aunt Mimi, who was privy to hearing Love Me Do before the rest of the world. What was her take on Love Me Do?
Yes, I'm gonna read this quote. It's a very Aunt Mimi quote. If you think you're going to make a fortune with that, you've got another thing coming.
Nice. She was supportive.
Very supportive, always encouraging. Yes.
And so, first of all, that's a little bit short-sighted, to say the least.
Yes. This is the song that was ultimately going to lead to her getting a lovely new bungalow. So,
yes.
You know.
And when John was recording the song, chances are he was also using the same guitar to play to Aunt Mimi. He was playing a 1962 Gibson J160E. Now, I'm not up. I like guitars, but I'm not up on my gear fetish. No. I'm not totally abrupt in this. But this is a guitar that they use a lot for gigging in 62, 63.
Yes, and I think George and John had sort of a pair, or they had a matching set. But it disappeared in December 1963. It was stolen after the Finsbury Park Christmas show, and just completely disappeared for 50 years.
Until
an amateur guitarist called John McCaw discovered that he had it. He had bought this in the late 1960s, not knowing there was any connection. Mm. All these things have kind of serial numbers and what have you. So he did what any amateur guitarist would do, and put it up for auction in November 2015. And you're not going to make a fortune with that, said Aunt Mimi.
Yeah, and the guitar sold at auction for $2.41 million.
So there you go.
Even
if there was no royalties coming in.
Yeah, the guitar would have made money. Yes. I mean, maybe Aunt Mimi could see into the future and realize that Paul would own the publishing and not John. That's probably what
that's
she was
probably
referring
it. To. Paul would own the publishing and somebody else would sell the guitar. She was more clear-sighted than we're giving her credit for.
But there you go. Love Me Do. It was 60 years ago today. I think we've done October the 5th justice. Shall we do the same thing again next year?
Yeah, see you this same time next year.
No, I'm sure we'll be back before that. But we remain available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, 7,000 members and growing strong. The website, www.nothingisrealpod.com, where you can see the links to the other bits and pieces that we've done and the other social media platforms that we don't really engage with as much as Twitter and Facebook. But we'll be there if you want to chat to us about 1962. And happy birthday, Love Me Do.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. For Nothing Is Real, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.